Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everybody. This is Ryan Orok, live on the air with Duversity Radio as part of the Imagine Rural Development Initiative. And I'm here today with Stephen Putter. Hello, Stephen.
Hi, Ryan. How are you?
Good. How are you doing down in Zambia today? We wanted to talk a little bit today, or a lot today, actually, because it's a gigantic topic about education. And this is one of those topics that may seem a bit daunting, as it's such a giant system and process and the problems in some places, including the developed world, especially the United States, even the United States, seem gigantic at the moment. And I just wanted to start off with a couple paragraphs from a couple articles about what the situation is like so that we can see what we're dealing with. Now, the first one comes from the Huffington Post, February 2nd, 2012, and it's called Long-Term Unemployment and College Graduates. And I'll just read one paragraph of that. It says, college graduates and advanced degree holders, once they're unemployed, are as vulnerable as high school dropouts to long-term joblessness, a new study has found. 35% of unemployed college graduates and those with advanced degrees have been without a job for more than a year, the same rate as unemployed high school dropouts, according to a EPU Fiscal Analysis Initiative study published Wednesday. In fact, the long-term unemployment rate for those 25 and older without a job is the same across all levels of educational attainment. So basically, once you lose a job and you're unemployed for a little while, doesn't matter whether you're a high school dropout or a PhD, you have the same percentage chance of getting a new job. Now, coming from USA Today, a weak labor market, starting the quote, a weak labor market already has left half of young college graduates either jobless or unemployed in positions that don't fully use their skills and knowledge. Young adults with bachelor's degrees are increasingly scraping by in lower wage jobs, waiter or waitress, bartender, retail clerk, or receptionist, for example. And that's confounding their hopes a degree would pay off despite higher tuition and mounting student loans. About 1.5 million, or 53.6% of bachelor's degree holders under the age of 25 last year were jobless or underemployed, the highest share in the last 11 years. And I could continue with various things about education, just explaining the predicament we're in as far as employment and self-sustainability goes, even in the so-called developed world. But I'll get into some of that later. First of all, I want to talk to Stephen here, who's been studying this topic with Imagine for some time. What do you see as the purpose of education, and what's gone wrong?
Well, first and foremost, let me say that there is actually, in the statistics and figures, there is actually no difference anywhere else on the planet. Maybe one or two exceptions that I don't really know about, but the tendencies and the graphs is all going into the same direction. Now, to understand education, we have to look at the history of education. Education as formal education, the way that we know education today, really started in conjunction with the Industrial Revolution. Because of the Industrial Revolution and the massive growth that actually jumped out of the Industrial Revolution, it was desperately needed to actually train people for that industry and for the subsequent lines of specialization that came out of that industry. And education is good. Today, education is good for that particular industry, for modern society, the corporate side of society, the production side of society. Education is good for that. But we have to ask ourselves, what is the measurement of good education in the first place? Now, you will see that if you start studying the measurements of quality in education, that there is this big fixation on standardized testing. And the better the test results is, the better we say education is doing. But it's almost like education has separated itself from reality. For the simple fact, and this is the simple fact that has, that we need to look at. What is the purpose of education to begin with? The real purpose of education is to actually produce somebody that's educated enough to sustain himself.
Right.
Now, if a community actually is planting tomatoes and we just keep on planting tomatoes and nobody can eat the tomatoes and the tomatoes is going rotten, are we going to keep on planting tomatoes? No, we're not. We're going to stop. We're going to say, listen, we actually have got enough tomatoes now. And in education, we're not doing that. We're just turning out massive amount of students and we're forcing the students to go through the system that is designed for a particular aspect of sustainability. And more children now and young people now actually find that there is no place in that crate that's going to the market. There is simply no work for them. And in my opinion, that is a failure on the side of education, because the end result of education at the end of the day has to actually leave the person in a situation or with the skills where he can sustain himself. So the measurement of education should be the sustainability of the person after education. It does not matter if he's actually fitting into the current paradigm for what education was designed for or not. He still has to, through his education, actually pick up the tools that is necessary to go into sustainability.
Right. Sorry, were you done? Or?
Yes.
Okay. You know, and I wanted to jump in there real quick, because you take a bit more charitable view of our educational system than I do. And some of the things that I've read, for example, are traditionally craftsmen, throughout the centuries had guilds, were very well paid, and, they had certain ways that they tried to keep their craft pure. They avoided competition, whether you were a bricklayer or a stone cutter or whatever it was you were. And then the Industrial Revolution came along and you had these craftsmen working on cars, and you had a few craftsmen, for example, you know, creating a car, maybe with the knowledge to create an entire car. However, if the craftsmen, and there were a few of them, they were very skilled, decided they wanted more money, they were holding capital, for example, a bit hostage and able to demand good conditions, etc. So the idea of the assembly line, which we all praise, was, well, what if I take what the craftsman can do and cut that down into such small pieces that none of them can build an entire car by themselves, and actually the nut or bolt that each person turns is useless as a skill for itself, which means we don't need to train craftsmen anymore. The labor can be done cheaply, and if the employees start complaining, then we can just replace them with someone else who turns the bolt. And if they get kicked out of this particular Ford factory, they have no special skills compared to anyone else in the labor market, and so they can't demand any superior payment. Now, that's one thing I read. And the other side of it is we have our office jobs. Well, in an office job, if you're working for a bank or an insurance company or whatever, basically your understanding has to reach the point to understand the form, to fill it out. You don't have to be super educated for that. That's why a lot of these jobs are getting replaced by electronic telephone services, etc. today. So, I mean, we can question these processes. I don't know how magnanimous they were, coming from the Prussian system and the Industrial Revolution, but it reminds me of, you know, what is the typical child working in a sweatshop stitching Nikes for 12 hours a day today? What kind of useful skill does that person actually have to sustain themselves when the Nike factory decides it goes to a cheaper place?
Well, that is one of the problems. Now, if we look at sustainability, We have to, you cannot look at education divorced from society today. You cannot look at education divorced from economics today. And we know that on both sides, there's a lot of things wrong. First of all, we are consumer-based society. Economics are based on consumerism. Yet we cut the amount of consumers that can consume the products by actually centralization, mechanization. And then on the other hand, you've got a double whammy of a problem because 100 years ago, 70% of the American population was actually employed by agriculture. Today it's 2%. So we have changed the systems from an expanding model into an imploding model. And it baffles my brains that we are wondering why it's not working. Obviously, when your economic system is based on trade and capital flow, then you actually have to create the people that can actually let the capital flow. We have gone the opposite direction and hoped for a positive result. That's like trying to go someplace but reversing in the opposite direction, hoping you're still going to get to your destination. It simply doesn't make sense.
Right. Now, you're talking about standardized tests as being the be-all, do-all, and that we have to get away from that into sustainability. From a global perspective, do you think that governments are going to implement better systems for this, or what do you see as the way out?
Governments cannot implement what they don't know. You know, we as human beings have fallen into a slot of, what can I call it, of entitlement. We think that there has to be somebody on the planet that's going to actually deliver everything to us while we're sitting under the tree. Well, the last one that got that right was Buddha. The rest of us will actually have to learn to participate rather than to sit and wait for things to come to us. And that's also where your economic power lies. Now, in sustainability, when we talk about sustainability, it's a community's ability to sustain itself to the maximum. There will always be trade because in Water's Edge, for instance, there is no salt pan there. I cannot create salt there. So what I can create on Water's Edge, I have to create in surplus so that the things that I cannot create there myself, I can still trade with other communities. That does help salt to bring salt in. And that is the trade that needs to take place. So what we have done is we have centralized everything. Okay, we're carting stuff that can actually be grown locally from one side of the planet to the other side of the planet. And at the same time, we're complaining about carbon greenhouse warming, global warming and all the things. But our systems on the biosphere is actually also working against what we actually need to do on the ground. Now, it doesn't help we actually wait for the government to actually correct systems. We need to start actually being active and integrated into our communities and ask ourselves in our communities, what is it that we can do to actually bring the cost of living down, get more money flowing for the things that we really need that cannot actually be created in the community? What is happening now? Now you start creating opportunity, you start creating jobs, you start creating commerce, you're reducing waste. And it's this integration between community life and the potential of the community, the potential of the resources in the community, and the knowledge base in the school about the potential within the community that needs to be brought back. In a sense, we have taken education out of life and life out of education. And the two should actually be integrated to each other. the child that doesn't fit into the system, at least then can actually use his community for his sustainability, which reduces the pressure on health, welfare, the prison systems. Doesn't matter where you look, by actually just actually getting active within the community. A lot of the ills that a very small amount of people now has to pay for can actually be taken out, and it can be turned into a positive rather than a negative. But the integration between the community and the school and education actually needs to take place again. In Zambia, a child can go through his whole school without actually learning how to actually look after the resources in his community. Therefore, he cannot actually manage his resources when he comes out of school because it's never been integrated in real life in his community. And why split the two? We said we take children and we sit them, put them in a little box that we call a classroom, and we do everything two-dimensionally for them on a blackboard, maybe with a little bit of new media thrown in between. But that doesn't hold the child's attention. Hence, we have got so many problems in school with children that does not behave. Take the same system. The model that we use in Water's Edge, that we're going to use in Water's Edge and some other communities, we did not have to change the curriculum. We're just changing the lesson plans, and we're adapting that lesson plans and actually taking that lesson plans and incorporating it into the natural curiosity of the child. Because maths, science, chemistry, biology, language, literacy, everything can be built into things that kids are really curious about. We need to actually use the kids' curiosity about the environment in order to take the curriculum and actually present the lesson plans in relation to their curiosity about the well-being of their community. And that's the piece of education for me that needs to change.
Okay, let me go back just a moment and recapitulate so that we're sure we got all this. So first of all, the educational system now, based as it is upon standardized tests, and I love what you said, we've taken the education out of life and life out of education. And anyone who's had a small child, a three-year-old, a six-year-old, their favorite question is why? It's not like children have no curiosity and don't want to learn. Learning to walk, learning to speak, these are massive, massive investments of time and energy, and it just happens. We don't need to say, okay, now you're going to go to walking school to learn to walk. And yet we send kids to school to learn all of these things which we label as important or valuable, but I think that's such a valuable point. We've got resources all around us, regardless of where you live. And you can go through school. No one taught me how do I manage the water that's locally. It comes out of the tap. I can pour motor oil down the drain. What difference does it make? It gets taken care of somehow, even here in the United States. So I think even deeper to look at local communities that actually have land bases, which they can use, and how to prevent those land bases from getting polluted. I mean, it's actually a duh thought, but it's something that education so far has just ignored. So I think that's an excellent statement. And if I can just say one more thing, I also love your point of view with that. You can look at a local community. You don't need to wait on lesson plans from Washington, from the capital of Zambia or South Africa or whatever to decide how to use your local resources. So that empowers, say, parents, teachers, even children, to make changes in their education, standardized tests be damned. And this new society that we're creating, we don't have to create the complete blueprint and know everything about it before we can make changes to education. So I just think those are excellent points, and I'm very glad you've made them. I'm glad I'm hearing this logic in the field of education, where most of the time what I see if I look in the newspaper is arguments about budgets and more money and hiring more teachers or etc., etc., they seem to completely miss the point, at least in the West. So you want to go on, Stephen?
Well, once again, you know, we talk about the West, but it's pretty normal, because you have to remember that the developing countries now has actually taken and adopted their models from the West.
Right.
So whatever we speak of in the West, we're talking about exactly the same models being implemented in developing countries. There is some developing countries like Brazil and another couple of countries that really is starting to do things differently. But there's another facet on about education, and you actually brought up quite a nice example of, you know, let's throw the oil in the drain, for instance. The Earth is such a small place, and it's such a fragile ecology. Ecologically, it's fragile. All right? We cannot afford to actually test every little stream in every village on this Earth based on the current model. But imagine if conservation itself is part of the curriculum, where the children in their biology class go out to the local stream and they take water samples, they take monsters, they take it back, they test it in chemistry, they look through the microscopes in biology, they take photos, they upload that to the internet so that the collective intelligence can actually say to that school, this little organism that you don't understand, that you don't know about, is actually this and this and this. We need to actually start managing the biosphere. The only rational way to do it is through the educational system. And let me tell you, I have never seen a child that actually looks at a water sample through a microscope out of the local river that is not totally captivated by what he is seeing.
Really? Uh-huh.
Okay. And through just changing our educational system by really making it interesting, we can collect data globally. There is no place that is impacted by humans that is not part of a school district. Just think about that just for a moment. There is not a space on the planet that is not a school district where we had human impact. Doesn't matter how deep you go into Africa, there might not be a clinic, but I can guarantee you there's a school. Now, if we start actually saying this planet belongs to the children, we actually managing this for the children. We are here to guide the children. We are here to say to the children, listen, you're doing something in your community wrong because the algae is actually starting to take the oxygen out of the water in your water system. Or there's human effluent in your water system. And you can only know that if somebody actually goes and tests that. What are we teaching kids about the environment? What are we teaching kids about their sustainability? Why try and teach them something on a blackboard where they cannot actually have the physical experience?
Right.
If you do something, if you can see, touch, smell something, if it's a new experience, then that learning gets ingrained in the neurology, because you actually ingrain that knowledge through all five senses. So your associations to recall that knowledge is based on the senses, say the full sensory experience of the learning experience, rather than the squeaking of a blackboard, where you sit on a hard chair, where your bum is so sore that all you actually think about is your bum. You're not actually really thinking about what's happening on the board. Do you understand the difference between education in the model that we are proposing and education as it's taking place today?
You know, I love this, and this reminds me of tell me and I'll forget, the proverb, tell me and I'll forget, show me and I may remember, involve me and I will understand. And this is something, it's like, it's the difference between learning a language in a classroom You know, when I was learning German, okay, you have to memorize this table. Ich, du, sie, es, wir, sie. You know, memorizing empty, but actually using a language, actually having to go out to the store to order things is a completely different experience. And this motivation, you learn so much better. So I think that's a absolutely key item. And why have we made education so cold and boring? It doesn't need to be that. It's fascinating, like you said, to go out and look at the water. And let me just take a moment to tell our listeners now, if you'd like to call in, we have the facility to call in. Is that okay, Stephen, if people call in with questions?
Yes, brilliant.
Okay. Well, let me just give out the number really quick. You can call us at 646-652-4075 if you have questions for Stephen, and we can go into those. I'll give you the number one more time, 646-652-4075. We're still figuring this out a bit, so we might have a couple bumps with this, but it would be great if people have questions or comments that they would call up and participate with us. And what you're talking about, I think it's been very hard for many of us to understand this new society because we've never seen anything like that. Maybe a few hundred years ago it was normal for kids to be very integrated into what was going on, but we've never seen this participatory educational system. I was certainly sitting on hard chairs for 12 years plus, and also the system, the educational system, is connected to financial systems, the governmental systems, and so it's difficult to just change one little screw of these systems because the environment is connected to education, is connected to politics, is connected to economics. And then the values that our education is based on, for example, competition and memorization, judgment by an authority figure. How do these work into your thoughts and what you're doing at Water's Edge?
Well, education for us should be a creative and an innovative process. Okay. The children of today in a community, that is their community. We have created that community, but it's equal to our creation or our non-creation in a lot of instances here, because there's very few communities that actually is creating collectively.
What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Well, the government will say, let's make that a park, and they will put a park there. And there will be an empty lot there and an empty piece of land there. And the community doesn't engage. The piece of empty land is there. It's lying there for years and years and years and years. And it's because of the disengagement of the community about the well-being and the creation of a community where people would actually love to live. Where people can actually find a lot of resources that can actually help them by reducing their expenditure. There is very few people in communities that you speak about, that you speak to today, that doesn't tell you they wish they had more cash. But what are we doing as communities to actually reduce that what we need to give out to actually live? There's a wonderful community, and I posted it on my post in the UK, excuse me, where they are actually planting vegetables and fruits in public spaces, even in front of the police station. They've got fruits. And I will post it again for the people that is on my timeline. I will post it again because it actually shows the essence of what actually happens when a community actually starts just doing things together, creating things together. It taps into the creative principle of people, in the innovation principle of people.
One moment, Stephen.
There people goes.
We actually yes. We have a call here. You mind if I take that real quick?
Please take it.
Okay, let's take the call. I've been waiting a couple minutes here. Hello. Who's calling?
Hello. My name is Michael Josefowicz, and I'm calling from Brooklyn, New York.
Oh, welcome, Michael. It's great that you're listening.
Hi. I posted a couple of comments at the board, but I think it's important things that there might be a blind spot in the mainstream media as to how much education is changing in the United States. And the blind spot, I think, is journalists. I'll be glad to post a bunch of links on the thing, but right now higher education has changed dramatically. Are you aware of what MIT and Harvard are doing?
Oh, absolutely, and I wanted to get into that
right
later, but go ahead. Yeah, give us...
Right, and underneath, it's interesting that the same stresses and the same conversation is happening all over the world. This is not an American problem. This is a problem that every single country you look at in the developed world is looking at the same problem. Spain, Greece, all of them have and of course in the Middle East, you have massive unemployment among educated people. And the way I see it is it's a global, when you have the same thing happening all over the globe, then there's probably global reasons. And the global reasons, I think, are pretty clear. It's the end of the industrial age, the beginning of the knowledge economy. And on a financial basis, what you're looking at is the end of America's default hegemony in the world. It's very clear that we're entering a world where there are multiple players: Brazil, Indonesia, India, China, of course. But many other countries that are moving to be agile and making their own decisions. And in that context, the only kind of workforce that's going to work are people who can make smart decisions on the ground. And so I heard you before talk about service, the bank teller. You
right.
mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in service economies now, what you have to look at is Starbucks, not the bank teller. And one of the reasons that Starbucks is doing so well, they have an intensive training program for their people.
So doing education in-house.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and I think really what we're going to look at, my hunch, and it sounds a little far off, but my hunch is we're going to see public education focus like a laser on making sure everybody's literate and numerate.
Uh-huh.
And then by someplace around the 8th and 9th grade, kids are going to learn however they learn. They'll either learn through Khan Academy, they'll get trained on the job, they'll get trained by the military, they'll get trained by corporations, they'll get trained by their friends. They'll start businesses. I posted a thing on your site, but are you aware that 30% of the American workforce is now freelance?
Now, yeah, first the question, I don't see exactly where you're posting that, so I'm... I'm
all right,
sorry.
So it doesn't matter. I'm posting it on the page
okay.
of your Blog Talk Radio.
Oh, okay. Well, we got a chat window that I'm seeing here, but I'm not saying. Yeah.
All right. I think folks might be missing the massive reorganization of the American labor force.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want you, it's excellent that you brought up Harvard and MIT.
Yep.
And I think you're referring to the fact that they're putting all their courses online for free now?
Yeah, and not only that, but what they're doing is they're going to allow you to take a certificate proving that you took that course successfully. Now,
really?
It's not an and it's not an MIT degree, don't get me wrong.
Right.
But you will be able to go to an employer and say, I took this course, this course, this course, and this course. Now, what I fully expect to happen is that very soon employers will be much more interested in what courses you took than what degree you have.
Right.
The BA degree has been basically devalued over the last 15 years in the United States.
Yep.
Right? So,
absolutely.
All right, you have a BA. Nobody's going to hire you because you have a BA.
Right.
And in fact, what we're seeing now is nobody's going to hire you because you have an MA.
Right.
They want to know, what did you do? They look you in the eye. Are you a good person, a bad person? They make a guess. I just had a nephew who was hired by HSBC. This is after a degree, blah, 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 blah. They put him through a 9-week training course that he loved.
Mm-hmm.
And he loved it because it was completely job-related. And so you have an outfit like HSBC who are training their own, because they can't depend on the education system to train them. And quite frankly, my feeling is, aside from expert literacy and numeracy, the education system is not set up to do it. They
right.
never were. They
right.
never were. You know, if you look at the stats for value add of education, once you hold family background constant, there's no value add. Never has been.
Right.
It's a filter. It's been filtering. It's always been filtering. But now, education, higher education, especially in the States, has gotten so unsustainably expensive that with MIT, Harvard, there's any number of new startups that are giving education for half the price, a quarter of the price, none of the price, free. And one can only imagine within the next 3-4 years, you know, and once people start seeing the legitimacy of it, I think the higher ed bubble cracks.
Right, yeah, absolutely.
It just disappears. And then once that cracks, then seeing K-12 as being all about academic and getting into college, that cracks.
The whole thing's coming down. Now, let's not...
It really is.
Right, and we don't want to get too far. I mean, you're making excellent points here.
Okay. That's all I really wanted to get on the radar. I think the thing about Stephen's place is that you should get him to talk about sounds.
Sounds.
And sounds. Brenda Erickson and sounds and where that fits into what he's doing.
Okay.
It's about early childhood literacy. It's an amazing program that comes out of Georgia and will be part of what he's doing at Water's Edge. But I think Stephen, because he's in Zambia, that doesn't have all the legacy bullshit, will be able to be a model that will teach a lot of the world about what works. You should also get him to talk about Shugata Mitra. Are you familiar with Mitra's work?
Stephen?
Are you familiar with an Indian, M-I-T-R-A, his work? It's Hole in the Wall. It's a great story. Stephen probably knows it.
Hi, Stephen. Can you hear it? Can you hear me?
Yes, yes. No, I'm here. Ryan, let me just introduce you and to the other listeners. Michael, he's part of the family. He's part of the Water's Edge family. Michael has a passion that every child shall read. Every child, not some
planet.
Children, every child shall read on the planet. And within our whole systems design and our design that we have done so far and the project on the incubator at Water's Edge is actually based on a lot of the things that Michael is talking about. Brenda from Sounds and Sounds Principles is absolutely brilliant. Now, hopefully the people that listen, please tune in on Friday. I couldn't get hold of Brenda for this show because I'm sure people are tired of hearing me speak already. We're going to get Brenda on the show on Friday. Absolutely brilliant. Mitra's work in India, absolutely brilliant. New paradigms in education, peer education, brilliant systems. This is all the aspects that we will be covering in the radio shows, which will be regular on Tuesdays and Fridays. Am I correct, Ryan?
Right, yeah.
So same time?
Yeah, exactly. Tuesdays, Fridays, 10 a.m. Pacific. That makes it 1 p.m. New York time, Eastern. So, yeah, and 7 p.m. Zambia time, Tuesdays, Fridays, exactly.
Cool.
Wow, you guys,
well,
this is one of our experts for the call-in show. Good, Michael, thanks.
What I think we see, what I see, and I think Stephen sees also, is that the new innovations in education are all out there. They're all out there. In New York, in the States, there's an outfit at Harvard who has done work on visible thinking. In Australia and much of Southeast Asia, it's centered in primary year, I forget what it stands for, PYP, which comes out of the International Baccalaureate. In Europe, the best place I've seen so far is in Barcelona. And what Zambia allows us to do is to stop worrying about getting a legacy system to pay attention It takes too long. The fight is too long. They don't get it. But if we have the opportunity at water's edge to put some of the leading practices from around the world into practice, then people will see it. My own guess is that sub-Sahara Africa is going to lead the way. Isn't that a riot? But I really believe that. And it's exactly because of the absence of legacy social structures and now the new changes in Africa. I mean, there's a reason that every hedge fund in the world is circling around sub-Sahara Africa. Carlyle just went in, every one of them. And they're all trying to figure out how to exploit the situation, and they will.
So there's not too much creative destruction that needs to take place before new
exactly,
systems can...
Exactly. It's what Christensen says about disruptive innovation. It has to come from the bottom of the pyramid because the players at the top are too busy protecting their business. How is NYU going to say, take MITx? I mean, one of the things we've talked about, and I don't know if it's going to happen, but there's a lot of things on the drawing board, is to set up a class on Water's Edge where kids, local kids, take MITx courses.
Why not?
They'll essentially take courses at Harvard, at MIT, not everybody, and then they'll have mentors and they'll be able to do it with peer learning. That can't happen in the United States. There are too many interests that will not let that happen. But there's no reason in the world that they can't happen at Water's Edge. I mean, as soon as Stephen builds his ICT structure, we have everything we need. It's done.
Well, yeah, but with unemployment of new college grads at 50% plus, I mean, how far does it go till, does it have to go before, you know, we'll accept that this paradigm isn't working?
I think it's going to go pretty soon. If you take a look at Obama's policies in the States, people tend to misunderstand it, but it's all about vocational education.
Really?
All. Yeah. The academics don't see it because they still think higher ed is where it goes. Kathy Davidson at Duke University, in a Guardian article about 3 or 4 weeks ago, now months ago maybe now, I don't remember, predicted that 2012 will be the year of free elite higher education. And that was before MITx came out. And I think she's right. There's little doubt to me. And that sooner or later, some middle-class person who's looking at a $200,000 bill is going to say, darling, here's $50,000. Go volunteer in Ecuador and take your courses from Harvard or MIT online and get certificates.
Now, what exactly, if I can ask Michael, is your part
sure.
of this? Is this professionally that you're doing this already?
Nah, I'm a retired printer. I got nothing else to do. I'm 60. I'm 65 years old. You know, I got to do something, and I hate golf.
Well, it's great so, that we also have this paradigm that once you're 65, you're useless, and we should go put you in a, we should go put you in a home somewhere and keep you away.
Yeah, you
from,
could try.
Yeah,
you want to
know.
Try to put me in a home. No, actually, the other thing that I think is missed.
Yeah.
Is that the we're seeing people live to 80.
Yeah, absolutely.
And people see that as a huge drain on the society.
Mm-hmm.
But they're wrong. What it is a huge cognitive surplus with amazing buying power. And 65, I mean, I'm a very early baby boomer. So yeah. I've always been like in the lead of my generation.
Right.
You know baby boomers ain't going to go gently into the night. Are you out of your mind now that we have money?
Right.
So, but seriously, I think that is also, I think what people are missing is that they're looking everything with a glass half empty look.
Right.
If you look at it the other way, what you're looking at is a couple of things. One, the amount of entrepreneurial energy among recent college grads is amazing.
Mm-hmm.
You probably know, I don't know how old you are, but every college grad I know is doing this business or that business or freelancing or this or running to Williamsburg or doing whatever it is they do, right?
Mm-hmm.
Second, you have this amazing cognitive surplus that's going to be coming online with baby boomers like me.
Right.
We've lived our lives. We want to make things suck a little bit less.
Yeah, what a resource,
And the third thing people are missing is that if the creativity is unlocked from the bottom of the pyramid, people of color, the new amount of knowledge that moves into society will be as staggering as when women joined the workforce.
Wow.
I mean, 1970, there were no girls to speak of. And now we're looking at a world where I think of the top five global companies in the printing industry, which I know real well, are run by women, and nobody thinks about it anymore. Before women got their rights, those ladies would have been school teachers instead of corporate executives. So I think things look really good myself.
Well, I appreciate you bringing that in here. The resources of wisdom and experience of that older generation and ceasing to encapsulate everyone apart. The young people need to stay away from the old people, just hang around with, you know, their one class here. What a waste, you know?
Absolutely. And then it just moves. I mean, what happens is that communication allows us to move back to a society that we had before industrialism forced everybody to leave house and go work in a factory.
Right.
I mean, what's more natural that grandparents and parents and kids and grandkids basically all being families and watching out for each other and teaching each other? I mean, why wouldn't that happen if it can?
And then even more than that, neighbors and friends and everybody around.
Yeah. I mean, the way I see it is the most serious, not serious, but the most resilient place that culture happens is in families. It always did. It always will.
Traditions, rituals, everything there.
Everything. Knowledge. How do I act? What am I supposed to do? You learn it from your mother and your father. Right. You don't learn it from a school.
Right.
And now with Skype and Twitter and blog talk radio, there's no reason in the world why parents, grandparents, great-grandparents can't all stay in touch every day.
Right.
Pretty cool.
Amazing, regardless of where they are.
Yep.
In actual fact, it's a very much needed part of whole systems design, because at the moment, society is actually taking old people and actually moving not only their value, but their dignity outside of community.
Exactly. So true, Steve.
And it's
so true.
It's a loss for us. It's a total loss for society as a whole. Imagine in our system, what we are doing is we're bringing the pensioners into early childhood education.
It's beautiful.
Because where
so
would the
beautiful.
Old people rather want to be than actually with their grandchildren? So it's bringing the different spectrums of community together. The old people with the early learners, the collective intelligence with the grassroots, the actual conditions in the community, the soil, the quality of the water, the quality of the river, the agriculture. Bring that data to the collective intelligence right at the top, and actually merge the systems into each other. That makes much more sense than the secular society that we have built up, where we're so disconnected that we don't even know where the pollution in our river is coming from, that we don't even know that what we are eating and paying through our necks for has been carted from halfway around the world, and it can actually grow on your windowsill.
I think the most exciting part to me is that the demands that you mentioned, Stephen, are precisely the same things that the international global market wants. That's what economy needs now. And so you get an agile company like Kata coming out of India, perfect model of what's going to work moving forward. And every American corporation is in the process of trying to figure out how to be more agile, how to be more responsive. Social media has made authenticity the coin of the realm. You can't bullshit anybody on social media. You know, you can do it for like about 3 seconds,
right,
but that's about it. You know, and I think that that's one of the reasons that Romney in the States is in such trouble. Poor guy, he forgot about YouTube. He really did. It's like John Stewart said, don't these guys know that we have them on video? And so Obama now is making up a campaign. He's just going back to all the YouTube videos. And he said, you know, now Romney, latest with Romney, he says he saved the auto industry. I mean, who's going to buy that? You know, and it's a level of transparency that the technology and the economy wants. So it's a nice conjunction of history moving to the right side again, I think.
Yes, and the other aspect, of course, that is coming into play now more and more is actual personal relationship that is actually not limited by nationality or community.
How crazy personal relationship. Even that you and I have become friends from one tweet, and now 3 weeks later or 4 weeks later, we're completely intertwined on this project in Zambia, along with people from India and the Netherlands. It's crazy. It's crazy.
And this just showed the power of collective intelligence that can actually come together. But also in the same way, actually touch the ground almost on any place in the planet. I don't think we fully, as the human race, I don't think we fully understand the potential of technology and modern society.
But I think what the thing that you've brought to the table that I have not seen yet, I've been on Twitter for 3 years, okay? What you bring to the table is bringing it down to earth. And so there's lots of stuff on the social media about we have to do this and we have to do that and we have to do the other thing. But until it gets into a real pace with real people, with real stakes involved, it doesn't happen.
Right.
But now that Stephen has done this amazing work at Water's Edge, all of a sudden it's focused attention from all over the world. It's very exciting stuff.
One person actually doing it is worth 1,000.
You got that right. You got that right. All you need is one person really doing it, and then it comes down like a tornado. There's like this tornado that's about 15 feet above the ground, and as soon as it hits the earth, man, pew.
I know.
Cool.
I know so many carbon coaches and environment experts who are living just like I do, flying around, driving big cars, or, you know, much more consumptive.
Yeah.
But Stephen's the guy who's doing it, isn't he?
Yeah, every day. He took his wife and his kids and moved them out of Lusaka out to the rural areas. He's an amazing man.
So we're not getting tired hearing from you, Stephen. You know what it's about. That's why I asked to interview you, and that's why I enjoy doing this.
Gentlemen, I need to beg off now. Thank you so much for having this show. It's just it's another blessing of the internet, you know?
Thank you, Michael, for your...
Okay.
Thank you for popping in.
Sure. Take care. Bye-bye.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thanks.
Wow. So you met Michael on Twitter a few weeks ago?
Yeah. Well, it's longer than a few weeks ago, although time is a relative thing.
And now Putin's
really
involved.
Well, you know, it's... Today... It's about what makes sense and what the vision is and what is the next step that we need to do to actually make it happen. We have spent so many years, Ryan, in theory, and we have taken these theories and we have beaten the life out of them from every side that you can think of. And before the theory is actually implemented, somebody comes up with a little bit of a twist in the theory, and then we go into a new cycle developing new theories. What we are saying is that the technology is there. There is amazing things, like Michael say, with Mitra and sounds happening in education. brilliant new models are being built, successfully tested already in diverse circumstances. And it's just for us to actually say, let's actually create the space. Let's create the space. Let's bring the best that we know of that is readily available. The best in education, the best in technology. Let's bring it together into a whole system where that whole system can actually work in a symbiotic relationship with the rest of the biosphere. And let's introduce community after community, and let's make communities incubators to actually go and actually seed other communities so that we can actually start working together as a species. And education is the root. Education and nutrition is the root to that. I don't think we will actually move as a species unless we actually recognize the fact that education should be a path of discovery, a path of curiosity, a sense of wonder, a sense of creation, a creative activity. If you can get the children to actually integrate the education into the community in relation to the vision that they have for that community, by the time that they have finished education, the community has shaped themselves around the future desires of the young people in the community.
So it's a bit vision, and it's a bit magical, actually, to hear you talking about it. It's education is everything but the cold theoretical mind-based, let's argue about this theory and then create a new theory. This is how we've been for, I don't know, 100 years, maybe longer, as a result of enlightenment or why we're so like that. So that's one point. And the other point that I just want to make, or not make, but just repeat, is that you're not inventing educational systems that have never existed before. We've solved these problems in small ways in small places. The question is just putting all the new systems, all the building blocks together. And I guess that's what you as a systems theorist and systems manager and systems expert are doing, right?
Well, it's unrealistic. You know, I always say to my team, you know, I'm not an agriculturist. But I've got a brilliant person on board that farms with nature, that actually uses natural species in the environment. He's the expert. There is people in education that is absolute experts that has shown and proven their results.
Right.
On different levels, from early literacy right through to postgraduate. Why are we not actually utilizing this tremendous resource in expertise that we have and actually bring it together to form the best model that we can? Why are we fighting each other while the only ones at the end of the day paying for it is the children? Because those are the ones that we are failing.
Right.
You know, and if we don't change it, we can just as well put up another three factories that produces Ritalin.
Right.
Because attention disorder is not going to go away.
Well, it reminds me of the quote, don't try to convince someone of something whose livelihood depends on him not understanding what it is you're trying to explain. Or don't try to help someone understand, or, you know, someone will not try and understand it. If, you know, we have this new paradigm, we have teachers saying, oh my goodness, what am I going to do? You know, where am I going to work? Or, you know, is that what's fighting against us? Or why are we not picking up these new systems and models?
I think in a sense that is, fear is a big, is
fear,
a big,
right.
Retainer of what is. Because simply of the reason that we are afraid to lose what we have. But things are changing so fast. Technology, communications, you know, borders are dissolving. as far as social media is concerned. So social interaction. Social media. Let's call it social interaction, because that's really what it is. You know, people are connecting with different people. People are searching. I think the world actually knows this. The species can feel in their bones that things have not gone right. So everybody that has access to information automatically becomes a searcher. Some of them search for what is wrong. Some of them gets driven mad by conspiracy theories. You know, there's all these different genres in personal connections all over the planet. But most of them is actually looking for solutions. And I think most of the people actually are tapping in these new solutions, and it's happening more and more at greater and greater numbers. If you look at online programs like TED, for instance, I'm a very big TED fan. I mean, I love watching their shows. There's been a couple of shows. Mitra has been on TED. With the hole-in-the-wall system that he has developed in India, and has been running trials on that for the last couple of years already. And we know the results that comes out of it. So more and more people are exposed to it. So this fear that we have that is keeping the current paradigm in place might also be the thing that actually makes those people that fear the most, that's trying to keep the system the way that it is because they fear that they're going to lose. It might still work out to be their biggest loss in the end of the day, because if they don't start changing to the best practices now, the best practices will be implemented around them and they will find themselves out of place and out of space in a new paradigm. So It's not about us anymore, you know. It's not about it's not about me anymore. It's really about our future and the future of our children, and it's really about us as a species on this small little planet that we have to actually try and heal to a sense where our children will actually thank us one day and say, you know, hey, you guys did a great job. Instead of wanting to murder us because we've actually murdered their future. And it's those kinds of things that we really, as individuals, start to look at. There is no personal safety. There's no personal security. The individual security can only be equal to the security of the whole. We cannot blame the children of actually taking to the streets, because we have created a system where they don't fit in and that's the only way to survive. It's not the children's fault that they're actually rioting. It's our fault, because we have created the system. And we have created that system in full knowledge that they are there, because we have created them.
Fear creates.
So it's a failure on our side.
Right. Fear creates that which we're trying to avoid very often, right?
Yeah, fear is the best creator of all, eh? It keeps our focus, it keeps our attention, and it creates a perspective. And it's about climbing beyond fear. It's about not fearing the new, not fearing the best systems, not trying to retain what we have, but actually embracing the newness, embracing the solutions, embracing the innovative, the innovation. And understanding that, you know, there is no real failure. There's feedback. And if we don't do the very systems design based on constant feedback, then there is a problem with the system in itself. Because systems is supposed to be constantly evolving, you know, but we don't have the feedback. We have separate pockets of feedback, but we don't have a holistic feedback. From this little biosphere that we call planet Earth. And that can be corrected through the educational system.
So what place do children have in contributing to their own education, their own educational systems? Are they going to be designing these things? Are they going to be telling us what they're learning? Or how's that going to be?
I see children as the future teachers, with us being good custodians.
Just enabling them to learn what it is that they feel they need to learn. Is that a way of saying it, or no?
Partly yes, because the world of tomorrow is their dream. It's not really our dream, is it?
Right.
It's their dream. It's their world. How do we guide them? How do we support them? How do we take our intelligence and our wisdom and actually show them how to use that to attain their dream?
As opposed to our conditioning and what we've been taught is true, which is plainly not working in a lot of areas.
Well, I mean, we just have to look at the current state of the world to understand that maybe we were not as wise as we thought we were. You know, it's not about leaving the world to the children to run amok in. I think if children's curiosity is invoked in relation to their dreams and the well-being of the environment and the potential of the environment, I don't think you have to worry too much about it. People inherently are good. Children inherently are better than people.
Putting more trust in the world and its ability to produce and the children is going to create dramatically different results than being afraid that everything is wrong and we need to fix it. We need to put force into it, especially violence into it, to get it to be right, to make well-adjusted kids. And if they're not sitting down well, then gosh darn, then we need to fix them and give them drugs and things. And that is a vicious circle that will go on forever if we keep pursuing it, and I think a lot of people are abandoning it, and you're showing them how to abandon it, so that's fantastic.
Well, we are trying. We are trying. But you know, it's a collective creation. It's not Water's Edge. It's not really Stephen doing Water's Edge at all. It's actually a collective team from all over the world that is actually going to do the creative part of Water's Edge. We've got a standard joke in the group that I'm the Mad Hatter. You know, I'm the Mad Hatter. I'm just inviting everybody to the tea party, so to speak, to come and do their brilliance. And man, we've got brilliant people out there. There is such brilliant people. And you know, the other brilliant people that think that they have got something very brilliant to actually include into the system in Water's Edge, they are welcome to contact us and bring to the table what they have. And if it's better than what we have at the moment, it will be incorporated. And this is the biggest thing that we have to learn. It's not about being right. It's about what is right. There's a difference between the two.
Just out of curiosity.
What is the best?
Right. How do you decide what gets implemented? Do you guys all vote on it? Or what is the leadership structure like?
There is no real dogmatic leadership structure. If something comes on the table, we discuss it. And we actually use linguistic calculus and reason to actually see if it can move us from the current paradigm to the vision that we have of every child being able to read, of every child having nutrition, of actually being able to actually collect the data on the biosphere and present it in such a way, let's bring the best together and let's just take that step and say, let's do something not for ourselves. Let's do something that's related to the reality on the ground in relation to a vision where we can actually live the abundance that this planet can actually afford us. And let's do it together. And let's be open-minded enough and flexible enough to actually say it's not about my system, it's not about me, it's about creating the whole picture.